message is for Robert Davis. This is Officer Rockhold at the Purdue Police Department. As far as the computer terminal is concerned, that he had possession of it through off the University Street garage.
Welcome to the Plastic Podcast. I'm Robert Davis. I sat down recently to have a conversation with J. Robert Parks about Her, the new film by Spike Jonze, and Computer Chess, the new film by Andrew Bajalski, which have nothing in common, of course. That's, you know, that's what we do. We juxtapose. And by the way, the second film, Computer Chess, has the unusual distinction of being available right now on all five of the streaming services that I keep an eye on. So if any of this sounds intriguing to you, you can find the film on iTunes, Amazon, Hulu, Netflix, or Fandor. And maybe on a plastic disc somewhere, too. I'm not sure. Do they still make those? And one more thing. In the time since our last episode, I seem to have forgotten pretty much everything about how to record my own voice for a podcast. So while it may sound like I'm Skyping into this conversation, J. Robert and I were actually sitting in the same room a few feet apart. And I only hope that our conversation is interesting enough that you can overlook all of that. Completely ignore it. You won't even notice. You won't notice at all how terrible my microphone is. And we'll try to improve it next time. It's like riding a bike, they say. But what they don't tell you is you don't notice that you've fallen until a day later when you look down and your knees are all banged up. Anyway, here's J. Robert Parks.
Hi, Rob.
Hey, J. Robert.
It's been a long time.
It's been a really long time, yeah.
But it's nice to get back together and do this. We've seen a few good movies lately, and that kind of, in particular, we saw a movie together, Her, the new Spike Jonze film starring Joaquin Phoenix, and that kind of inspired us to get back and doing a little bit of podcasting.
Yeah.
It's set in the near future, in what is passes for L.A., and Joaquin Phoenix plays a guy by the name of Theodore Twombly, whose job is writing letters for other people. He knows these people, at least he knows them sort of through their requests and what kind of letter they want him to write. And some of them, he's been writing letters for them for decades. And then he sort of writes these beautifully, you know, emotionally crafted letters. It's funny, the name of the company is called BeautifulWrittenLetters.com.
Beautiful Handwritten Letters.
That's right, BeautifulHandwrittenLetters.com. But they're not handwritten, of course. They're done on a computer. And but then they send them off. And so he has this great kind of emotional connection with these people that he's writing for, and yet he himself is sort of emotionally stunted. He's going through a divorce, which has kind of left him emotionally crippled. But then at the beginning of the film, he sort of finds out about this new computer operating system that sort of, you know, responds. It's a version of artificial intelligence, and it will respond to him and sort of get to know him. And so he decides to install this on his computer, and before too long, he's involved in a relationship with her. Her name is Samantha, and she's voiced by Scarlett Johansson. That may sound creepy and weird, I think to the movie's great credit, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure, the movie sees it as a little weird. It doesn't sort of see this as natural, and yet it imagines a world in the near future where this is conceivable, if also still a bit weird. But what I find particularly powerful about the film is this idea that of what it would be like to have a relationship with a computer operating system and how that may or may not be completely different from the kinds of relationships that we have today, and what that says about both romance and relationships, but also about where media might be taking us. And so as strange as the idea sounds, it's actually, I think, really compelling in the film.
Yeah, and the key to the idea working or being plausible is just how gradual it is.
Yes.
I mean, we start in a world where, at first, it's not entirely clear, are we even in the future? Mm. But then you begin to see, of course we must be, because I see signs, street signs, that we're in Los Angeles, but this doesn't look like Los Angeles to
right.
me. I don't
right.
recognize these buildings. It's very, it's denser. Everybody's mm-hmm. walking. There's transit. So some, you know, things that we don't associate with Los Angeles
right.
are here. But also, everyone is communicating with their phone mm-hmm. on transit as we see nowadays, but they do it with this little thing that's in their ear. So they're mm-hmm. sort of talking, they're giving a lot of commands, and there are a lot of simple responses. You know, you read the next message, and mm-hmm. there's a voice that summarizes the next message for you. Throw that one away, next message, you know. Right. So right. it's beyond what we can do now, but it's sort of in the realm of mm-hmm. understandable. And then Samantha, the new operating, I can't remember the name of the operating system, but the one that is crafted for him is mm-hmm. Samantha. Just seems like a natural outgrowth of that. It's mm-hmm. like a smarter one, and it mm-hmm. fills in a lot more gaps and can communicate a lot better. Mm-hmm. A lot better, it turns out. Mm-hmm. Enough that it really gives you the impression that it's a person you're mm-hmm. talking to. It feels very, very personal after a while.
Yep.
And because we sort of are with him when he installs it and experiences it for the first time, and he's sort of blown away by it too, mm-hmm. We come along for the ride, I mm-hmm. think. And this isn't a new idea in science fiction that's been, you know, done lots of times, that, you know, the way people interact with robots and artificial intelligence is going to be, you know, a thorny problem in the future. If any science fiction is a predictor of what's going to happen. But the key to it is subtlety, is just mm-hmm. being able to do it very carefully.
Yeah,
that you're along for the ride. The audience is along for the ride the entire time.
Yeah, and I think it helps greatly that both Phoenix and Johansson are fantastic. You know, I think Joaquin Phoenix just gives a great performance, and he's incredibly believable. But Scarlett Johansson, I mean, does this disembodied voice, is also extraordinarily believable and approachable. And you can imagine that you might want to have a conversation with this OS. And you can imagine that you might find more comfort in talking with her than you might in a more complicated human-to-human kind of relationship. And so I don't think if they had the two actors that we do, it would be as approachable as the movie is. But you really do kind of settle in quickly into it.
Yeah, it really hinges on her being very personable. If she were a real person, you might think maybe she's a little too familiar, a little bit flirty even. Mm. That's sort of the level of how she talks to you. I was kind of two minds about the Scarlett Johansson performance, because I think she is really good and I think that's important. But I also wish that it weren't someone I could visualize. Mm. Like, I could picture Scarlett Johansson saying these things because we've seen her in a million movies. That was something different from what Joaquin Phoenix's character experiences, where it's a complete blank slate.
Yeah,
I don't know
what
he's imagining, and it isn't for us either. And if it had been a completely unknown actor, it might have been a little more interesting.
No, that's interesting. I kind of like her voice anyway, and so I guess there was just a kind of a natural attraction there. But yeah, I can see what you mean. If it was completely someone new and different, one thing that's interesting too about her, not as an actor, but just the way her performance in the movie is she's very believable as an OS that is reflecting back to Twombly's character what he wants.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the, for me, provocative questions to ask is when, obviously in any kind of relationship, we're hoping that the people we're with are compatible with us, that somehow they understand us. But what would it mean to have a computer OS that sort of learned you so well that it could sort of reflect and mirror back to you exactly what you want?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what kind of relationship would that be? And I think Johansson's voice performance is particularly good at that, sort of understanding what Twombly is looking for, and then, you know, just reflecting that back completely to him, at least for the first while in the relationship.
And also sort of knowing what liberties she can take. He has this pile of emails. She's like, you should get rid of some of this stuff. And he's like, yeah, but you know, there's things in there that I wrote that are good, and I don't want to lose those. And she's like, well, I looked through, and there are 86 good ones. We'll save those, throw away the others. And he's like, great, this is what I didn't have time to do. And
Yes, that's not quite how software is working for us today. But it's interesting to imagine that that's what it could be.
Yeah.
You know, and there's this moment towards the end of the film where she actually, without even his knowledge, designs a book of all these letters he's written. And it's a beautiful book, and everyone thinks it's wonderful and should be published. But it's interesting then to think about, you know, well, he was the author of those letters, but what does it mean that his computer has compiled them and chosen which ones and has sort of put all this together even without him realizing it?
Uh-huh.
You know, where does, you know, the question of agency then I think becomes really important in that.
Yeah, and also the juncture between the virtual world and the physical world. Mm-hmm. This is something that's going to be printed in an actual physical book, which is something that he likes about this publisher. They still publish books. You
right.
know, it's sort of antiquated, but you can imagine that there are still people who like that experience, just mm-hmm. like now. You know, you can get most books through Amazon or whatever, but you can also hold the physical book, and for some things that's definitely preferable.
Right.
And he likes that about this publisher, and so there's this meeting of the physical world and the virtual world that happens over and over in this movie. She wishes that she had a body, she says. And yeah. It's almost funny summarizing it so quickly like this, because in the movie it's like, it makes perfect sense.
Yes.
We've come to realize that's sort of the main thing that they lack in their relationship, is she's completely amorphous. She doesn't have any sort of physical representation. But there are all these ways that she can sort of express that anyway. Mm-hmm. He goes to a fair and closes his eyes, and she tells him where to walk. She has a little camera on his phone-like thing that, so she can see, and they have this lots of fun with her leading him around and leading him to the hot dog stand and saying he'd like a hot dog, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Other stranger attempts where she has a surrogate come over to have sex with him, which is something that they're not able to do except sort of over the phone, which doesn't end up working out well, because it's too strange for him, and this is an example of where the movie understands what its limits are, and where we're going to reach this point where we don't follow this story as far as maybe Samantha would like us to.
Yeah, that scene, which happens, I think, right about in the center of the film, is really powerful, because Samantha and Twombly have had a kind of phone sex, and Twombly seems actually comfortable with that. It's Samantha who isn't. And so she arranges, without his knowledge, this idea of agency becomes really vital here. But she arranges for a surrogate who she's kind of brought into the relationship. She's shared with a surrogate woman.
An actual woman.
Yeah. But she's shared like the emails they have and various different things, so that the surrogate feels like she knows what this relationship is. And then Twombly has to interact with her. While Samantha is talking and directing, and the movie, I think, to its great credit, understands how incredibly awkward this would be. I think Spike Jonze's sense of things is really strong, in that there's things that might initially feel awkward, and yet we come to accept them, but then other things that are just too awkward for us to accept. And I think the movie kind of plays with those in really useful ways.
Well, something I've always liked about him as a filmmaker, this even goes back to being John Malkovich, is that he'll introduce a crazy premise, but it doesn't end with the introduction.
Right.
He pursues it from that point. What if you really did work on the floor that was halfway between two other floors?
Right.
Wouldn't that mean, yes, it would mean, let's follow that through. All these sort of little things that if you really think about them, lead to something else, that you then can think about and lead to something else. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely on display here. All of these things that I there were around the middle of the movie, I felt like I was thinking of all of these things, about what if this, what if this?
Yeah.
And there was lots of evidence that he was doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
You also, though, have to be a good editor, because this really could go in a thousand different ways. It's vast, the difference between Theo or Theodore and Samantha, when you get right down to it. We'll get to that in a second, I think. But the surrogate thing is also interesting, because I had this question of, so she's a prostitute, and it's exactly what he asks.
Yeah.
Samantha, well, so wait a minute. When she's explaining this plan she has, he's like, well, she's a prostitute. And she's like, no money changes hands. And I feel like this is an interesting view of this world, because why would that woman, a beautiful woman, want to even... Why would she do this? Mm-hmm. But we're in a world where there's a lot of separation between people. We have people who are hiring other people to write letters for each other. I get the feeling that some of the letters he's writing the response will be written by someone else who's writing a letter for someone. There are many layers there. The people are in the subway listening to looking at their little screens. That's an echo of where we are currently.
Yeah.
There is a lot of separation in this world, and you could imagine that perhaps even now, but especially in a world that's even more that way, people might want some sort of physical participation. She wants to be a sort of pretend like she's in this relationship, but then have none of the trappings of it later. And she actually seems personally hurt when it doesn't work out. The surrogate, when it doesn't work. And she seems feel like she's failed. She just wants this. She says something about how she just wanted to be a part of it. It's an interesting, subtle part of this story.
It is. I think, and I think Jones lays this out really beautifully in the beginning, because we have a few different scenes early in the film where all we see is people just interacting with their screens. And it, actually, it's a little disorienting at first because it feels like they're talking to someone else. And then you realize they're not talking to someone else. They're talking into their earpiece and they're talking to the, you know, their computer or their iPhone or whatever. And it sort of sets up this idea of how media then separates us. And as we get more used to that kind of filtered interactions, it would make sense then that the next step would be, well, you have almost a completely, you know, mediated experience of relationships. But yes, you're right that at some point that becomes unsatisfying. But even though it might be unsatisfying and we might want to then sort of step into something deeper, those sort of real, and I put real in quotation marks here, those kind of real relationships are really messy. And I think that's, you know, we have examples of this, two different examples of divorce or breaking up in, well, actually, I guess three if you count other ones, but two sort of person-to-person divorces in the movie. And the messiness of those, again, I think the movie captures really beautifully. I particularly like, we haven't talked much about Amy Adams' character, but she's actually maybe my favorite character in the movie. And so at one point, she's in this relationship that we know early on isn't good for her. But then when she breaks up, her way of describing that felt so real to me and so tangible. And yet the pain of that is, you know, it's palpable on her face, and you can go, I could see why you might want something more mediated. That the realness of that is tough to handle.
Yeah. She's Theo's friend, and so she's talking to him, explaining what happened, and the breakup was, seems like a long time in coming, but it was precipitated by a, you know, a pointless argument, as yep. these things often are. And the way she retells it, yeah, it's just, it feels really real.
Yeah,
the performance and the things she's saying, everything about it. But it's also this idea of wanting other people to behave a certain way
yes.
is echoed
yes.
repeatedly, even at the very beginning, before we have any of this artificial intelligence stuff. He just has, Theo just has phone sex with an anonymous person, and she's telling
him, hilarious phone sex.
Yes, it gets hilarious because she's telling him something very specific she wants him to do in a certain way, and that's how these things work. No, do this, do this, do this. All right, I'm doing this. No, do this. Say it again. You know, she's sort of directing him in that way, and this happens a lot in the movie.
Yeah.
Where even the video games they're playing, they're sort of controlling an alternate self through this mm-hmm. thing. Tell it to go over here, tell it to go over here. Or the Amy Adams character is working on a new video game that's being developed where you tell them, you tell the mom how to take care of the children in this scenario and hope that the "you're failing your children" does not blink on the top of the screen.
Well, and the goal of that game is, of course, to make other mothers jealous.
It's, yes. The line of moms at the drop-off point at school, they've got to be jealous and get a lot more points of your perfect parenting. Yeah, but this the telling of someone what to do, I think, so we've talked a lot about sort of how the virtual aspects of the story work, but really the point is they all connect to the very
yes.
real, as you said, person-to-person
yeah.
relationships that are here. Like, yeah. I'm not what you want me to be is sort of one of the things that shows up in a real relationship. You want this sort of simpler world than we really live in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's and I do, and that's what it, if all the movie was about was artificial intelligence and where the world might be in, say, 30 years, I think it would still actually be an interesting film. But for me, the movie has so much to say about how relationships happen now, both romantic ones as well as just regular sort of kind of friendships. And that sense of, particularly as we expect more from our media, and we expect more, and we expect when we get on Netflix, and Netflix can recommend movies or TV shows for us. You know, we expect all of our media to be able to reflect back to us what we really want. Well, what happens if we then start expecting the people in our lives to be the same? And what if we expect them to, you know, just give us what we want? I mean, that's not exactly a relationship. That's certainly not a friendship. But is that where we're going? And what does it mean if we think about relationships in that way? And I think the movie is fairly targeted in really smart ways of how that works or how that might be working now. And I found it compelling to think about.
Well, and it's also highlighted by the fact that she really starts out as his servant. I mean, her job, her purpose for existing
yeah.
is to help him with his work and
right.
and organize his data and run
yeah.
his computer. She's
yeah.
his operating system. She's his servant. And it made me think of a couple of other movie things. I thought of The Remains of the Day, which a novel I've been rereading recently by Kazuo Ishiguro. It was adapted into a well-known movie starring Anthony Hopkins, and I don't remember the movie very well, although I remember liking it better than the typical Merchant Ivory movie because it felt very focused on this character, and I was very interested in what that life is like. He's very proud of how well he runs a house.
Right.
But there's a section of the novel where the novel is written as a diary, so you get it all from his perspective. And he is working for an American man. He's a British man. He's always worked for English households. This is different to him because Americans, he's been told, and it turns out to be true, in his experience, they behave differently. They're not used to sort of the old way that houses are run in England. This new master is very outspoken in the way he talks. He's very and Stevens seems to think, what does he want from me? Am I supposed to just smile? Am I supposed to provide banter? What am I supposed to do? And he finally figures out a good smile that seems to be what how he was supposed to respond to some of these jokes. He tried to tell a joke one time, but it was too sort of slow, and it didn't seem to register with as a joke. But these kinds of things, as we're talking about how the computer is artificial intelligence in the future, it might be its purpose is to reflect what you want it to be. Well, that's shown up in human relationships as well, and here it's in this master-servant relationship where his job is to sort of look a certain way. I also thought of Imitation of Life, the Douglas Sirk movie, which germane to this conversation. Think about that title. I'm not sure what the title means in the Sirk movie, but it's certainly not about artificial intelligence directly. Of course, it predates that.
Yeah, but it's about servants, though.
It is about servants. These two women, a white woman and a black woman, start out as seeming friends. I see it as a friendship. The white woman becomes a famous star, hires the black woman to be her maid out of seeming kindness, and yet that sets up this impossible dynamic where the black woman is a servant for the white woman. We should talk about this movie someday, probably, because there's a lot here to unpack. It's really a great, great movie.
It is great.
But the thing I was thinking about in this movie, in relation to her, is that one of the things that Sirk does in that movie is he doesn't show you very much of the black woman's life. She's essentially a servant, and that's sort of you think that's the sphere of her world. That's her entire world.
Right.
There is a point, though, when she mentions wanting to go out and do something with some friends if it's all right, if they're not doing anything tomorrow. And her employer says, "Oh, it never occurred to me that you have friends." She says, "Well, I have lots of friends." And the way she says that with a smile is just like this knife. I have lots of friends.
Right, particularly because the white woman at the time doesn't.
Yeah, it's an interesting comparison. But also it's a completely invisible to us as the audience, invisible to this woman, her employer, who doesn't seem to care a lot about her life, really. And then the very end of the movie, through tragic circumstances, Sirk reveals the fullness of the community that this woman had in a devastating way, in a way that he really attempts to make us complicit in this the sin that we didn't really think that this was possible because we had placed certain limits on this woman that turned out not to be true.
Yeah, that's right.
And I feel like there are ways in which this is just true of basic human interaction, that we don't really know what other people are thinking or doing. We don't know where they are, what they're doing when we're not there. But part of getting to know someone, a spouse, a friend, is knowing them well enough that you can imagine what they're doing. You know what they might be thinking, and you know where you don't know. You are aware of that limit. And there is a time that's very enticing in the middle of her where you can sort of forget about all that stuff. Maybe this could work. If she doesn't have a body, but maybe that's the only difference. When really, the difference is vast between how humans think and computers think. Right. It used to be in the 50s, when people first started thinking about artificial intelligence, truly mimicking human intelligence in a computer, in a machine. They thought that if you could maybe come up with a computer that could play chess, you'd be on the path. You'd be on the way there, because chess is a very complex game, and when people play chess, they use their intuition. They use these sort of things that are seemingly purely human, that no other animal could do. And so if you could come up with a computer that could do that, you would have something that was close to thinking like a human. Well, it turns out by the 90s we had computers that were beating chess masters, but they don't think like humans. Computers solve this problem in a completely different way. They can search all these possible combinations vastly outthinking humans in that way, and yet it's nothing on the path toward having a conversation at all.
No. No, that's right. Yeah, if you read anything about the Turing experiments, where you know people, you win prizes for developing the the computer program that mimics human conversation the best, and you're trying to fool people who don't know whether you're talking to a real person or a computer. You know, the way you win that is by it's not by creating something that actually can have a conversation. It creates something that doesn't do anything but ask questions. And so it's, yeah, in a way it's that same idea that, you know, you don't, there's something a little bit perverse, and I like your point that sort of so much of human interaction is we don't tend to think about what that other person's life is, and yet part of having a relationship is getting to understand that and thinking about that, and what is my girlfriend doing today? I mean, that's, I know I'm feeling closer and closer to her if that's what I'm thinking about, and not what it's going to be like when we're together. What's my brother doing today? What's or even what's my tutoring student doing today? And thinking about, oh, I wonder what their day was like. And yet I think there is a sense, and her gets at this well, is that as a lot of our 21st century society revolves around satisfying our own personal needs, it becomes, I think, somewhat easier to ignore that question and to not think through, what does that person need or what does that person want? And the contrast to that, there's sort of two scenes in the movie that remind me of this question. One is towards the end of the film. Samantha and Theo go on a double date with this other couple, and it's and so Theo has his phone hooked up so that Samantha can see where they are. They're out in this sort of meadow, this beautiful place, and each one has a earphone so that they can hear everything and talk.
She can talk to all of them.
But that's a really weird scene. That's the one scene that doesn't really actually feel natural. It feels really odd to me. I don't know if you had the same experience, but it felt like, oh, this doesn't quite work. This doesn't seem to work as a kind of interaction and relationship. And I wasn't quite sure why. Maybe it's related to this. But it feels very different from a scene that happens earlier in the film where Theo has come to sort of comfort Amy in her house after the breakup. And they just interact in ways that feel so natural, to use that word again with sort of quotation marks around it, but it feels very different than the kind of interactions that are happening when Samantha's involved.
Well, yeah, I mean, even when Samantha just says, I was thinking about that thing you said mm-hmm. the other day, mm-hmm. think of how much you have to ignore to accept that statement.
Right.
I mean, she could think about that in a millisecond.
Right.
She could process anything she needs to process about it very briefly. She wasn't thinking. Everything about the way we understand language and what other people do is based on human limits and mm-hmm. about how humans work. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have any of those. What
That's
was
right.
she really doing?
That's
well,
right.
she may have been talking with 800 other people, or
right.
she may have been, and then these things become are revealed by the movie mm-hmm. and are sort of heartbreaking, but they were always there, right. and it was only willful ignorance that allowed yeah. you to forget about them. And it seems to make him think about his failing marriage. He mm-hmm. hasn't actually, I think the divorce is not final yet, almost like he's holding on to it as this shell
right.
of maybe it'll still, when he actually has her sign the papers, he watches her hover over the blank where she's supposed to put her name for a moment, hoping that maybe she won't, and then yeah. after a pause she does. The couple that they go on the double date with, I felt like one of the things maybe that that Jones was trying to do was show sort of different responses to this situation. Like, for one thing, he's a little embarrassed to say how much time he has spent with this mm-hmm. OS at first. Mm-hmm. He begins to sort of refer to her as his girlfriend,
right.
and you wonder, well, that's like a fantasy life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he feels embarrassed about that, too. And to some people, he blurts out, oh, it's an OS.
Mm-hmm.
And people react in different ways.
Sure.
Some people are like, are you crazy? His wife is like, oh, that's just perfect. You always wanted to have a fake, didn't want to have to deal with the reality.
Yeah.
But other people are like, oh, yeah, that's interesting. I'd like mm-hmm. to get to know her, too. You mm-hmm. know, they're very accepting, as people are, of different types of relationships now. I think
yeah.
it was sort of an attempt to reflect how that might mm-hmm. Appear in the future. And maybe it does feel strange watching it from the outside. Maybe if we were able to have one of those things in our mm-hmm. ears. And it's sort of a montage, so
mm-hmm.
we get a certain cinematic distance from it
yeah.
as well. But there are certain human interactions that just aren't reflected by mm-hmm. simply a voice. Like
yeah,
that.
That's right. I was you'd mentioned earlier about, you know, Scarlett Johansson and her role. It was hard for me not to think about the movie Lost in Translation as I was watching this one. Also stars Scarlett Johansson. Also a movie about sort of separation, about distance, about trying to overcome that in human relationships. But I wonder, and this may be reading too much into it, whether, because that movie was made by Sofia Coppola when she was, with Spike Jonze. And in fact, there's a fairly clear stand-in for Spike Jonze early in that film, played by Giovanni Ribisi. And he's this kind of, he's the reason Scarlett Johansson's in Tokyo in the first place. He's come to do a photo shoot. And but he's too preoccupied, and so he leaves Scarlett Johansson alone. And this movie feels almost like Spike Jonze's way of maybe understanding what it was like to be in a marriage that wasn't working. And I found that powerful. I don't know if that was a conscious decision on his part or even subconscious, but it feels significant to me that there's this interplay of those two movies about distance and about the dissolution of a relationship and the beginnings of other ones. So.
Well, you know, I think that's an important part of this movie's appeal for me too, because I didn't think about that during the movie, but you mentioned it afterward and it just seemed to sort of click. I know that this movie sort of fits all of my criteria for a great movie. I think there are things that aren't perfect about it, so I don't think it's a masterpiece necessarily, but it fits so many. I come out of the movie thinking about, what are humans?
Right.
What is our life like? Yeah. What is existence? You know, really huge questions, but also that does sort of show up with when I talk with my wife. And, you know, these very specific things that are about my life, my daily life.
Yeah.
And then the third piece is it's expression or exploration on the part of the filmmaker as an artist who is trying to figure out or make sense of or have some sort of poetic reflection on maybe a part of his life that's now past and is meaningful to us as well. But all of these things being intermingled is what's really pretty cool about this.
It is cool. It's funny, when we came out of the movie, because we saw this one together, you mentioned a movie that I hadn't seen, which is Computer Chess, the Andrew Bujalski film. And so I had a chance to go back and watch this in the last couple days. And it's amazing how much kind of overlap there is between the two. I think you know the movie a little bit better. You want to sort of describe that?
Yeah, well, maybe it'd be good to sort of mention who Andrew Bujalski is, too. This is his fourth film, I believe.
That sounds right.
Funny Ha Ha was his first, and Mutual Appreciation. And
I've seen both of those, and I like them very much.
And then Beeswax. Did you see Beeswax?
I have not.
Well, he's a young filmmaker who began making movies in the 2000s, I believe, and has been sort of lumped in with other people like Joe Swanberg and given a name called Mumblecore as for what they do. There's really very little linking him to these other filmmakers that are also labeled as Mumblecore filmmakers, although they both premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival, and so I think that's part of how these things happen. But they're all films about young people just talking. There's not a lot of action and plot like in other movies, and I think that's sort of one thing, I guess, that unites them. But he has, until now, shot his movies on film. They're very sort of classical in a sense. You know, Mutual Appreciation, his second movie, was black and white, really beautiful black and white.
Yeah.
Just young people talking about their lives and what they're going to do, and they feel very casual. In fact, they feel almost improvised, and they're not, in fact. They're written. It's a testament to how well they're written and how well they're executed, acted, and shot, and edited, that they feel very natural, but they're actually fully constructed. And I feel like this is a sort of a lie about Andrew Bujalski that people have adopted, and it's made them blind to what the movies really are, because when Beeswax rolled around, which you've got to see, it's much more, it's in the same vein as Funny Ha Ha and Mutual Appreciation. There's a young woman who has a shop, and she employs some people to work in her shop, and she's sometimes disappointed by them and has to deal with, you know, managerial issues. It's a very gentle movie. He seems to always like his characters.
Yeah, that's right.
I think, and the movies treat them very warmly, even with their flaws. And I read review after review of Beeswax that did not mention anything about the film being critical of its central character, but I find it very critical of her. She's not a good boss.
Okay.
People don't like working with her.
Okay.
And I think if you watch the movie on a very surface level, maybe you don't even pick up on this because they're all well-mannered people. There are no shouting matches. There's nobody throws things. But it's there, and you just, you know, it seems very clear to me. And you would only pick up on that if you knew that this was a constructed film. Mm. This wasn't accidentally observed when he said, okay, we're going to turn on the camera talk and we'll pick up some stuff and put it together.
Right.
This is a movie made that follows a character through an interesting arc. So Computer Chess, one of the things I like about it right off the bat is that it's completely, completely different from anything that I can even think of ever seen before.
No, it's
certainly
true.
Different from anything he's ever made.
No, it is.
It's shot on video, but on must be the oldest video cameras that you could find that still work.
No. And the movie is set in the 70s, and it's designed to sort of look like that. I mean, it's designed to look like it's made with, you know, really early VHS cameras, and it's an ugly looking grain.
And the titles on the screen are like they're from a computer. They're superimposed by some really terrible computer with these dots that make up the letters.
Yep.
But as if it were done by some AV person who dutifully recorded this conference, which is about chess and computers that play chess, and then he assembled it on the university's editing machine, and he put the titles on, and they said, "Hey, that's great. We'll keep that in the archives." It almost feels like a found object for a while, you know.
It does.
It's about this conference of these guys who've come together with the latest their work. They've been working on computer programs that play chess, and they're going to pit them against each other.
Yep.
So they're
is a real thing.
Yeah.
I mean, there are competitions. I don't know if there are anymore, but that used to be common. Every year, you know, you'd have the latest and newest software that would compete, and you'd crown a winner. So.
And in this competition, they also have a guy who calls himself a chess master. Someone rolls their eye. A guy in the audience rolls his eyes at that. But clearly, he's someone who prides himself on his chess skills, and he's challenged them to try to beat him at chess by the year 1984, and they're getting close. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's 82 or 83 or something in the movie. But so it's just about them all coming together. It's maybe a dozen six or seven different teams. They all lug their computers in there. They put them on the tables and. You know, they have a physical chessboard in front of them, and they sort of are the surrogates for the computers
yes, they
that are playing.
That's right.
But it's very primitive, you know, computer programming.
Yeah.
So that's a scene.
And it's interesting to then think about how this connects with her. Obviously, there's sort of, you know, just the basic questions of artificial intelligence, but that idea of surrogates then becomes important. And that idea of, I have no idea what, you know, this world would have been like. But everyone is incredibly awkward. You know, it sort of imagines, you know, the geekiest of the geeks, you know, who spend way more time with their computers than they do in personal interaction. And then they have to come together for this, you know, 2 or 3 day conference and you know, really struggle to interact. But that sense of, you know, but they also have these dreams, the dream of what one day will be, but also kind of fears of what that would look like, you know, if it happens, you know, what will happen if a computer can beat a human. I remember when did Kasparov lose to Big Blue? I want to say mid-90s.
Yeah, it was like 97 or so.
Yeah, but I remember the lead up to that was that, you know, this was going to be somehow some cataclysmic thing when a computer could beat a human at chess. And I remember even then I was thinking, really? I'm not sure that's so. I mean, I don't expect to be able to run faster than my car. But that the movie Computer Chess sort of captures this sense of, you know, a new frontier, a brave new world, you know, a sense of what happens when our computers are apparently smarter than we are. And that, you know, is echoed in her as well. And that, you know, imagining a world in the near future when what happens when our computers maybe get tired of interacting with us and start interacting with each other and what that looks like.
Yeah, one of the guys on one of the teams is having to deal with a bug. You know, it's very very early in the game. It's making some bad moves, even obvious bad moves. They're not chess masters who've written these programs, but even they can tell, well, this doesn't make sense. We gave up a queen and and now we're not going to take their queen.
That doesn't make sense.
What are we doing here? Yeah, so he's like, he's up late, you know, this is a multi-day sort of thing that they have in this little hotel, and he's up late trying to figure out what's wrong with this, and he finds his advisor, who was a man who comes into town to sort of observe. I think he's not one of the actively participating people, but he's written a lot of the code that they're basing their stuff on. He's an advisor to the team, and he has a family and a newborn child that he's dealing with, sort of, that's more his preoccupation at the moment. But he tries to explain, you know, the young guy who's trying to deal with a bug is, you can tell his imagination is starting to run wild. Maybe he's not the best programmer, but he's starting to fear this creation. He's thinking, it's like it doesn't want to play another computer. Whenever I had it play her, yeah, there's this other woman on the team, the only lady who's there, they keep saying, we have a lady in the competition this year, and we welcome that. That struck me as very true to life, the way that was treated. But he has her make some of the moves, and it seems like his program responds better. And he tells the advisor that, and the advisor is like, how many data points are we talking about? Like 12? I mean, this is a program. He starts going into all this jargon that is becomes a jumble in the guy's head because it's even edited as sort of a montage. Yeah. Well, no, I wrote the Fortran program, and it's going to have to.
That's right.
This is the custom thing, and it's going to look up the keys on the hash and find all that. And this guy would rather sort of think of it in a poetic way, I think. And the film almost drifts into his head, I believe, and becomes a sort of a dream.
It's true.
As the people start to seem more like chess pieces moving on a board, and people are writing predictive algorithms to know who's going to go into what room. Yeah.
It's funny. And at the end of that conversation, it's maybe the funniest moment in the movie. And that movie, by the way, is really funny. I just laughed a lot in computer chess.
Weird kind of humor.
Yes. Yes, but there's at one point at the end of that conversation, he's trying to say, you know, and at that point, we've lost our sanity. Sort of, you know, and then you cut to this group of other people who are in the hotel who are doing this kind of marriage encounter thing, and they're doing this kind of really weird meditation, and it's a really funny cut, but this sense of, you know, we have these two extremes here. We have the, you know, the computer programmers, and then we have these people who are into, you know, sort of late 70s est, and and as if the, you know, so these are the two poles of, and somewhere in the middle must be sanity.
Yeah, and where those people sometimes meet is funny. They end up having to sort of wrangle for the space that they're supposed to be using. Yeah. The conference room is in dispute. Which group is supposed to have it? The computer chess people or the marriage counseling people? And there are lots of interesting encounters between the two.
Yeah,
I have to tell this story that I thought of immediately when I started watching this movie. Was that so? They're using these old computers. We see them typing on a screen and a keyboard, but that's not the computer. That's a terminal that's connected to the computer.
Right.
A lot of them are using PDP-11, which is by DEC, the Digital Equipment Corporation. And this was a mini computer. Okay. Mini meaning it doesn't take up the size of a room. It's the size of a footlocker. It's miniature. So they have this terminal connected to a mini computer. And when I was in college, I wasn't old enough to be one of these guys in the early 80s, but I came like a decade later, and all this equipment was still there. You know, a big university still has all this stuff, and the freshmen get to use it because the upperclassmen get to use the latest stuff. So we would do my computer programming homework in these big rooms with fluorescent lighting and tons of these terminals that are all connected to a mini computer that we never saw. It's probably in the basement somewhere. Nowadays, I'm sure you do your homework on your laptop in your dorm room or wherever you want, but back then you had to go to one of these terminal rooms and you had to do your homework there. And working on these terminals was awful. The ergonomics is bad, the screens are bad, and of course we were using them when they were already old, so we didn't even have them as good as they were when they were new. And they were so bad, I thought, one of these days when I'm done with all this, I just want to dramatically destroy one of these somehow. So a couple of years later, a couple dozen people met me on the top of the University Street parking garage in Purdue, and I gave a short speech, and I heaved one of these off of the top, and it shattered at the bottom, and was a very satisfying experience. There was lots of applause and laughter. And then what happened next probably says a lot about what kind of rebel I am. These people followed me down to the bottom where I had a trash bag and was planning to clean it up because I'm not a vandal. I wasn't making a mess. I just wanted to make a symbolic statement. And what I didn't expect was before I had a chance to pick anything up, the police were there.
Oh.
And I got to ride in a police car.
Oh, very exciting.
Because the thing I didn't expect was that they thought I stole it.
Oh.
Now, I realize it looks like I must have just ripped one out in rage, run up there and thrown it down, but this was a premeditated act. And what they didn't realize is the university was getting rid of these things gradually, and that you could go to the university surplus shop and they would sell you one for $20. And so I thought, $20, I was a poor college student, but for this, I would do it. Something I've been imagining for years. So I bought one for $20 and threw it off, and there was a serial number on the circuit board on the back that the police dutifully wrote down, and I looked through my records. I couldn't find a receipt, but they said, well, we'll call the shop, and if that's where you got it, they'll have records of it. They have to keep records of these things. They did, and they left me a message the next morning on my answering machine, which exonerated me that, in fact, everything checked out. So that's what the first thing I thought of when I saw these guys working on these terminals was the day I destroyed the Region 20 at Purdue.
As you think about sort of computers and media and relationships, what do you think Computer Chess, the movie, is trying to say about those? I mean, for me, the movie, I admire the movie. I think it's actually really smart. And it feels a bit like a puzzle to me. It felt like the movie is, there's really interesting formal things going on. As the movie goes along, the video actually starts to break down in a variety of ways. The editing becomes really kind of odd, and you start having sort of, you know, different things. And so it's kind of fun to think about. But I couldn't personally get my arms around what the movie was trying to say about relationships and computers. Although I think it is. I just couldn't figure it out.
Yeah, well, I think it does. Yeah, I'm not sure it is saying anything too concrete, but okay. It's definitely at this juncture of sort of analog and digital. Mm. I mean, it's shot on video, but normally when we say things are on video, we mean digital. And mm-hmm. This is analog. This predates any sort of digital video. So just the fact that he found that equipment and shot it on that, and it shows through in every frame. It's very clear when you look at it, something's weird about this.
Yep.
Mostly in black and white. There are a couple of weird glimpses of color in the middle. It's like, what's happening here? Mm. But lots of these sort of junctures between sort of analog and digital and physical and virtual. And I think by setting it in this time period and choosing this story to tell, it really highlights how different the physical world and the computer world are. In her, it's blended so seamlessly that we're enticed by that, and we believe it for a while. Mm-hmm. It's much harder to believe in Computer Chess that these computers are autonomous, because we know how really simple they are,
right?
How simplistic they are compared to what we're carrying in our pockets now, compared to what we're recording and listening to this podcast on. Far more powerful than what they had then. So it's very clearly a fantasy, and so it's these guys who are sort of disconnected from other people and who are imagining how might I interact with other people. Mm-hmm. Does the way I interact with my computer tell me anything about that? Yeah. Does the way these computers might be interacting one day? They sort of have a late night session where they're, after a few scotches, they're talking about military implications of this stuff, and they're sort of extrapolating from where they are. And I don't know what Bajalski, thinks of all of that or is saying about any of that. It feels more like a riff and a sort of iteration on this rhythm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. It's interesting to go back to her. I had a similar kind of question about place in her. At the end of the movie, we both wanted to stick around to see where this was shot. And we were trying to guess. Well, it didn't seem like modern day L.A., but we were trying to figure out, was it L.A., but with a lot of CGI?
Which also didn't seem to be true. It looked very real.
That's right. There's a concreteness about her that's very impressive. And so when we realized that it was shot in Shanghai, or at least a lot of it was shot in Shanghai, it's like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. that felt right.
Change some street signs and call it L.A., and this is an imagination of what it might be like one day.
But the interesting thing as I was going home was thinking about, was it important to me that it was a real place? In other words, was there something different because it was actually real as opposed to CGI? I mean, going back to Lost in Translation, one of the things I thought that movie did beautifully was to situate itself in Tokyo and to use Tokyo as a way of feeling disoriented and not, take this real place and make it seem almost unreal. Her, it wouldn't have completely surprised me if it was just really good CGI. But I was trying to then think about, what would I think about that? What's this sort of intersection of real and quote-unquote not real? I think it's interesting to think about as a way of thinking then about how computers alter our idea of reality and just not. And this is what I think her is really great at, is often movies that are set in the future want to sort of wow us with how not today they are. Her feels like, I bet you that would be what it's like in 20 years or 40 years, however far that is away. That feels like that could be life. And And I was impressed by that.
Yeah, clothing fashions, they don't become weird and, you know, aluminum foil-like. They right. they look like the 50s.
Right.
Because things go in cycles.
That's
you know?
Right.
But yeah, I like your comments there about, about it being a real place. I think it does matter. It's almost like the whenever they get into this elevator, it has a, the elevator walls have a neat effect in this building mm-hmm. where they live. As mm-hmm. they go up, it sort of looks like they're going through trees. That yeah. are, you see the silhouettes of trees
right.
passing by on the outside of these walls. Now, I don't know how that effect is achieved in this elevator, but let's assume they're not in a forest.
Right.
It's like some sort of visual display.
Yeah.
But it's important that it be trees. It's important that it's sort of, it's not just lines.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that evokes this idea of we live in a real place.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't it, but maybe you remember trees.
yeah.
We also, I mentioned to you too that it was interesting to see this view of Los Angeles as dense and walkable mm-hmm. and transit oriented, and you said that seems optimistic to me, which I agree with. But it's also interesting that we both pinpointed, without knowing where it was shot, because we hadn't read a lot about this mm-hmm. movie, hadn't seen the end of the credits, we both knew this didn't look like CGI. I
mm-hmm.
mean, as good as
right.
computer graphics are,
right.
can't we still pick it out? This
yeah.
looks real.
Yeah.
It's like when you see computer chess, this looks strange.
Yes. yes.
I can't pinpoint what it is. Well, this was the same. It's like, I don't see where they inserted that building, but
mm-hmm.
that building's not in LA.
Right.
So yeah. it was interesting to see where it was shot.
Yeah, and then to take that back then to what it means that we're, we don't have the same question about Samantha, you know, that she seems real too, and yet we know sort of instinctively that it's not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that strikes me as an interesting conundrum. It's like, okay, you know, what is real in this relationship? What is real in this environment? What is real in this society? And as we move forward technologically, what are the implications for real life, however we want to define that?
Well, yeah, because I think if this were happening in real life, I would have all these questions about, well, you're going to age and she's not.
Yeah.
How can you be having this relationship? Or think about how technology changes. You need to make sure her memories are backed up somewhere because, I mean, really, you don't want
right.
to lose them in 20 years and
right.
she's gone to you. Like, and how is that going to, how are you going to transfer her to the latest equipment? And,
yeah.
you know, you've got to think about these things if this is your life partner.
Mm.
But I think part of the power of cinema is that we, in the middle period when he has not thought about any of those things, doesn't care about this because he's in the honeymoon phase
right.
of really puppy love, kind of he loves this new girlfriend.
Mm.
We get to go along for that ride because when you're watching a movie, you know that you're in an artificial world already. And
right.
you sort of want to go with whatever the rules are of that world.
That's right.
And so I'm not going to think about that stuff if the movie has chosen not to go down those
That's
paths.
Right.
Then the movie does go down those
yeah.
paths, and it feels very rewarding because
yeah.
it used that effect that the cinema has
mm-hmm.
to bring us into his world and then shatter it the same way his was.
Yeah, that's a great point, Rob. And I think that for me, as I think about, I mean, to talk about Unreal, you know, sort of modern day blockbusters, what I often find so frustrating about them as a movie watcher is how rarely they obey their own rules. I mean, in other words, yeah, when I enter that room, there is a artificiality about that, you know, when the lights go down, when the curtain comes up, and the movie begins. I mean, the excitement of that because I'm about to see something new. I'm about to see something different, and I'm willing to go along with that movie as long as there's some sort of consistency about it, right? As long as you know, what are the parameters in which this is taking place? And I think both Computer Chess and Her do that really beautifully. You know, very early on, we understand what kind of world we're in. We understand what kind of society this is, and I go along with that. Whereas when I walk into, you know, whatever the latest, you know, Marvel universe is, at least in the movies, it just seems like rules are meant to be broken. Oh, you know, this person can do this. Oh, until he can't do that. I mean, you know, we need to find some way to defeat this character. So now let's find the way that he doesn't obey the rules that we set out for him. And that's what I find frustrating about a lot of contemporary movies and what I really did like about Her and Computer Chess.
J. Robert, have you seen a good movie lately?
I had a chance to finally catch up with American Hustle, the new David Russell film. And I thought it was great. I thought it was really funny. I had kind of a stupid grin on my face the whole time. You know, it's a 70s con movie. And it really lives up to a 70s con movie. It's not quite as intricate as The Sting, but it's a little more worldly than I think The Sting was. But it feels of a piece with that and other sort of 70s con films. And I think Christian Bale's fantastic. I just think he's really great in sort of being true to this character, and yet a character that actually does seem to grow over the course of the film. Amy Adams is always welcome in any movie, and she is here too. It's good stuff, and I just laughed, and I thought it was fun, and I thought it was really well made, and old-fashioned Hollywood in the sense of, you know, let's tell a good story, let's have good acting, and let's do it. And that movie feels like it does that.
Cool. I want to see that. I'm always rooting for David O. Russell ever since Flirting with Disaster and Three Kings, basically.
Yeah. And it's not quite as funny as Flirting with Disaster, but there's a, I don't know, it's also not as caustic, and maybe that's a good thing. So how about you? What have you seen?
Well, I went on a Powell Pressburger kick lately, going back and watching the great movies.
There.
Yeah, these great British filmmakers. And my favorite, I think, so far is Black Narcissus, which is it's hard to describe, but these nuns go up 8,000 feet above sea level in the mountains.
Of India.
Of India to set up a school up there. And this is an awkward place to do that, and the movie goes to all lengths to show you that. It's really, really cool.
Yeah, it is. It's great. It's funny. I just saw that fairly recently, too, and loved it. So, yeah, awesome.
Nice.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Plastic Podcast. Jay, Robert, and I have actually been doing this podcast off and on for years now, sharing our conversations and also sometimes sharing our interviews that we do with filmmakers. And so we have an archive of 30-some episodes, and we've made it a little bit easier to find things in the archives now. We put them all on one website called plasticpodcast.com. You can find every episode there, along with notes about each one. And, of course, our feed. So if you have a podcast app, you can subscribe to our podcast and get the latest episode as it comes out. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Messages for Robert Davis. This is Officer Rockhold at the Purdue Police Department. As far as the computer terminal is concerned that he had possession of and threw off the University Street garage, everything's been confirmed that it was sold to him, and there's no problem anymore. He doesn't need to expect any problems. No paperwork glitches on this end. Everything checked out. Take care. Have a good semester.